My name's Nathan Haynes, and I'm with Ubuntu. And so my talk today, and forgive me, my phone is my presentation remote, not checking emails today. So I'm going to talk about computers for human beings, and this is a story about Ubuntu. And it's a story about computing. And the neat thing is it's actually in some ways sort of like a story, almost like an alternate universe story of computing. This is something Ubuntu follows a tradition of computer science and operating systems that's been around since, say, since Unix in the 70s and 80s. You could say since the big mainframes in the 50s. The story goes on and on. And so the story of computers is really, at many points, a story about people. So my name's Nathan Haynes, and speaking of people, we'll start with me. So I'm a computer enthusiast. I'm a programmer. When I first got my first computer, other than the Apple IIe's I saw in the classroom that we all had, you could play Oregon Trail and Number Muncher back in the 80s, my first computer was given to me by a family friend. It was an older one. You plug it into the TV, you turn it on. 2 seconds later, there's a big green screen. It's an extended color disk basic, OK, blinking cursor, and if you didn't load a program, you started writing a program because that's what computers were back then. So at 10, I said, great new toy, and I started programming. And so I do a little bit of programming. Obviously, as a child of the 80s, I'm also an avid video gamer. So I am a programmer. I'm an avid video gamer. I love technology. I love being able to do things with computers. And, of course, I'm a computer technician. I've been working with computers professionally for about 20 years now as a computer technician. I started in high school. And people would always ask me early on, especially in the 90s when computers were still sort of seen as magic more than they are now. See, people would say, you know, you're so young, how did you get so good at fixing computers? What's your secret? And the secret is when you're 12 and a half and you're changing config files around because you read something cool on a dial-up bulletin board, and you break the computer, you get really, really good at fixing it before your mom finds out. So I always say when I've been an instructor, and I always tell people when you make a mistake, especially in my Excel classes, if you don't get the result you wanted, that's good news because you're about to learn something. So you never have to be afraid to make mistakes. So that's who I am as far as a computer enthusiast. Lately, I'm also an author. So I've done a lot of technical writing and so on. I've written some introductory magazine articles about Ubuntu, and I'm currently working on a book. It's called Beginning Ubuntu Linux for Mac and Windows Users. It should be out this spring. I'm a little behind schedule. It turns out writing a 350-page book is a lot harder than writing a 4-page magazine article. But I'm really excited about it. So everyone here, most of us here, are really good with computers. We know Windows. We know Mac. A lot of beginning Ubuntu and Linux books kind of bring you from the very beginning. They tell you, this is a mouse, this is your hard drive, this is a file and folder. I think a lot of people really know that. So I think of learning a new operating system a lot like going to another country. I had the great privilege of studying German in college. And so one year after, during summer break, I visited a friend. I stayed in Germany for a month. And it was fantastic. And I knew the language. I'd studied some of the cultures. And I got along pretty easily. You know, everything pretty much made sense, especially the food. And so I didn't have too much trouble. But it's always these little things. So, for example, on the Autobahn, there's no speed limit. There's a suggested speed limit of 130 kilometers an hour, which I think is like 72 miles an hour, which if anyone driving in L.A. might be a little let down. But, you know, I didn't drive too much. My friend would drive. And so for 2.5 weeks, we were driving around, and one time we were going, and we were driving along, we see cars zipping back and forth across intersections, and then he would stop, and he'd go, and then every so often, there'd be cars zipping back and forth, and he wouldn't stop, and suddenly they would stop, and he'd keep going. And
So two and a half weeks, and I said, my friend Lutz, I said, all right, so you knew at one point that you had to stop. He's like, yes. And he's like, and they know that they have to stop. It's your turn. He looked at me and said, yes. I said, how? And he gave me this look. We're in the car presumably at a red light. I can't see the light. And I said, I know you have traffic lights in Germany. The word is die Ampel. I had to learn it in class, but I haven't seen not one. Where are these traffic lights? And he looked at me and he said, they're right there. The traffic lights in Germany are on the near side of the intersection. The ones on the far side, like we have here, are facing the other way. Right? And they're completely the same. There's red, yellow, and green. The only difference is that the red light starts blinking about 5 seconds before it turns. So if you're in the crosswalk, you might want to think about not being in the crosswalk because the cars are ready. So, you know, you run into these little tiny things when you're learning a new OS. And so that's sort of how I'm writing my book, is that you know how to use computers. So there's a bit about a big section on how to install, big section on translating back and forth, and the rest is all Ubuntu. So I'm hoping that's going to be pretty good. The publisher really liked it, so here's hoping. I'm also a member of the Ubuntu project. So some of you here I know use Ubuntu, and I'm a contributor. I learned about Ubuntu just when it came out, and it sounded odd. I said, well, I'm already learning this, and I'm not going to bother with this new one. And 6 months later, people were still raving about it. I said, well, it's free, and there must be something to it. No one would pick this and be excited if they weren't doing something right when there are all these other alternatives. So I got involved, and I loved it, and I started giving back. And so I'm a member of the Ubuntu local community team, and I will be discussing Ubuntu in great, great detail. So right now we know it's a software project, and then I'm going to go into it. The local team is basically an advocacy group in California. Whenever there's a computer group like this, or a Linux user group, or an expo like is coming up next month, for example, we provide speakers and sometimes discs, swag, you know, we run booths, and so on. So there were elections. I've been doing that since 2007 when the local team started, and just on the first of this month, I was actually elected to be the leader of the team. So that means mostly not getting in people's way, really, when they're doing really good work. We do speaking engagements. We used to do install fests when Linux was really hard to install. It isn't anymore, so those kind of went by the wayside. So some of us who have done those will be thinking about those wistfully, the way we think about floppy disks and modems, really. And release parties and so on. I'm also a member of the Ubuntu Local Community Council. And they're a group, a governing body in Ubuntu that oversees local community teams worldwide. I keep saying LOCO, which is short for local community team. And so when people ask us at booth, they see the sign that says LOCO. I just say, well, we're crazy about Ubuntu. I've been using Ubuntu for a very, very long time. Now, I've been using that word all the time, Ubuntu. And what Ubuntu is it really refers to three different things. It's a software project, which is an operating system. It's a community of people around that software project. And it is also an ancient African philosophy, and that kind of derives how the community treat each other. And I'm going to be talking about all of those things. So Ubuntu, as you might all see it, as a desktop operating system, is a complete solution for your computer. With an Ubuntu disk, you can do everything you need to do day to day on your computer, from the basic simple stuff all the way down to running servers and doing research and engineering and programming, just to checking your email and just the easy day to day stuff. So the nice thing about Ubuntu is that Ubuntu maintains security updates for all the software on your computer. It's resistant to viruses. I don't know of any Ubuntu viruses in the last 10 years that have been in the wild. And it's completely made of free and open source software. So free software is an interesting concept. And before I get into that, I want to just ground ourselves on one term. So Ubuntu is a computer operating system. So my question to all of you is, who can tell me what is an operating system? This is the interactive portion of the talk. So I had a joke answer. I expected someone to say, what's an operating system? People say, oh, Windows and Mac and Linux. And I'd say that is the correct answer to a different question. The correct answer to name some operating systems. Yeah, the operating system is something really special. So what an operating system does is it manages your computer and all the programs on it. It's the first thing when you turn on your computer, it's the first thing that runs off of disk. Note how specific I was. Don't count the BIOS. It comes off the disk, and it talks to all your hardware, gets them ready to go. It starts loading programs. It's the interface that you use to control your computer. And so we know operating systems. We've used them. MS-DOS was pretty good. I'm still nostalgic for that one. There's various versions of Windows. There was the old Mac OS. Now, of course, there's OS X. And there's Linux. There are others that aren't on the slide. There's VMS. There's Unix. There's BSD. There are a lot of other operating systems. These are the main ones we think of. And so Ubuntu is an operating system, and it's a specific variant of Linux. And so the neat thing about this is that Ubuntu is composed entirely of free software. And so as a Linux distro, Linux is a free operating system. Now, whenever you hear the word free, something's free, you always want to start looking for the catch. Right? There is a catch. So the catch is that free software is a term of art. When I say that Linux is free, I don't mean that it doesn't cost anything, although that's a nice side effect. It's not a requirement. Linux is free in the sense that you are given freedom in how you decide to use it. And so as free software, Linux is licensed in a way that gives you the freedom to use it and modify it and examine it and share it however you like. And so the sort of online joke is that Linux is free as in speech, not free as in beer. And so free software is very interesting. Free software is software that gives you, that guarantees you, through the license, four fundamental freedoms. And these were codified in 1983, 1984 by a computer hacker named Richard Stallman. A hacker in this instance is the old definition. It's a computer enthusiast who likes to just get things working. So he started, as computers do, with the number zero. So freedom number zero, the first freedom, is the freedom to run a program for any purpose. And we take this for granted. You go out and you buy software and you bring it home on your computer and you think, well, I'm going to use this however I want. I paid for it. It's mine. It's my computer, right? But non-free software often limits what you can do. For example, if you wanted to do word processing, you can go to Microsoft Office 365's website, sign in with your Microsoft account, and you are allowed to use Microsoft Word and Excel and so on online for personal use, for home use, personal use. You're not allowed to do that in a business. You have to pay extra for that. You have to buy, a Office Live subscription. I don't own that. So, a lot of software restricts what you can do with it. Free software says that you have the right to run a program for any purpose you so choose. So you can use it at home for personal use. You can use it for educational use. You can even use it to run your business. And so free software guarantees that freedom. It's easy to take for granted, but it doesn't just automatically come with running programs. The second freedom is the freedom to share a program with your neighbor. We all have neighbors. You know, if someone's having computer problems and their computer got infected by viruses and they're using Windows XP and it's out of support, Microsoft doesn't support it any longer, and what they really need to do is upgrade their version of Windows if they want to stick with Windows and have something supported. And if you have a copy of Windows 7, you are not allowed to give it to them. You cannot. The software, the license for the software prevents you from being a good neighbor and helping your neighbor or your friend. Free software does not do that. Free software gives you the freedom to be a good neighbor and to share software freely. Which, in the old days, that's how software was shared. And nowadays, we think that's sort of weird. Well, you buy software, they have to buy it too. Free software just gets away with that restriction. Free software gives you the freedom, guarantees you the freedom, to be a good neighbor. The other more important thing is that it also gives you the freedom to examine and modify a program. Programs are, we think of programs as sort of magic things that you install and you use. But computers aren't magic boxes. Computers are really fancy abacuses. They're really fancy calculators. And the only thing computers do are what you tell them. Everyone here knows this. Everyone here has used Word or Excel, and you want it to do one thing, and it's doing something else. Computers do not do what you mean, they do what you say. And that would be the killer feature, I think, for any computer, is do what I mean. But they don't have that feature yet. I'll be the first in line once that comes out. And so programs are a series of software instructions that your computer follows. And with free software, you have the right and the freedom to look at those software instructions and see how the program works. Now, in the old days, if you could use a computer, you were a programmer. That was just the way things were. You had to know enough about a computer to use it. And that's no longer the case. And so I myself, even though I know a little bit of Python, I don't really examine a lot of code. But there are a lot of people who do, and there are times when I might run into a bug on my computer, and I'm just tired of it, I decide to track it down, and I can read a little bit of C, and I know just enough where I can sort of narrow things down, and then hand it off to other people who know what they're doing. Or I can gather enough information and then talk to people and have a conversation. But free software gives me the only thing that's keeping me from examining software is whether or not I have the time and patience and knowledge. Because I have the freedom to examine that. And what that means, even though I'm not a programmer, it means that I can examine this, and I can know what runs on my computer. And in fact, I can talk to the developer, and if the developer of a free program doesn't want to fix a problem, I can go to anyone else who's a programmer, and I can ask a friend, I can hire someone. If I'm running a business and software does everything I need except for one feature or one bug, at the end, I can hire someone. I'm not locked into that vendor. I can hire anyone to examine the software and modify it. So it's a really powerful freedom that we've given up in many ways. And it sounds really specialist, but it's handy to have. Remember, these aren't requirements. You don't have to look at program source code to use free software, but you have the freedom to. And the last freedom, and the one that makes everything, just amplifies the power of everything else, and really makes everything come together, is the freedom to share your changes with the wider community. So if I have software and I decide that I want to fix it, or I want to add a new feature, I can keep that for myself. And you might ask, why would I want to do all this work, maybe pay someone to do work, and then give it away? That doesn't make any sense. And the interesting thing is so say I take LibreOffice, which is a free office suite, and I add a feature. And 3 months from now, a new version of LibreOffice comes out. And so I want to take that source code that was changed, and I want to take the new version, and I can spend time and I can add that feature back into the new version, and I have it again. And in another couple of months, when a new version comes out, I can stop what I'm doing, and I can try to port everything over, and as new versions come out, and the program changes more and more, I have to spend more time looking at what I've changed, and does that make sense in the new software. And you can do that work and keep it for yourself, and there's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes it makes more sense, and you have the right to. But if I pay for, or if I make a change to make software better for me, and I give it back to the project, say back to LibreOffice, for example, or back to Ubuntu, and they accept that change, the next version that comes out has that improvement. I don't have to do any extra work. It's already there. So the payment for that is now everyone else has that improvement too. But something funny happens when you freely share code and improvements. Sure, I spent some time and maybe some money making something better. But all the other users of that software are doing the exact same thing. And so when a lot of people together contribute to a software project, that project becomes way more better collectively as it would ever be individually. It's like stone soup, if anyone remembers that that children's story. You know, everyone, the whole village gets together and just someone has carrots and someone has onions and someone has some beef stock. And together, just a little bit here or there, they make a feast. And free software works the exact same way as it turns out. So even though it sounds like, why would I share everything? It ends up being a much better solution. So what happened was that I said computers were basically the history of computers is a history of people. And in 1983, Richard Stallman, who was a hacker, worked at MIT. And at the time, computers were giant mainframes, and you worked on little terminals, and you typed everything, and you typed in, it would run things, and you got a response. I don't think they used teletype terminals back then. They had video terminals, but it's that same idea. And so software at universities was basically free. At the time, computer vendors wanted to sell hardware. They didn't care about the software. Software is thrown in for free because you have to, if you have a computer, you want to do something with it, right? So the thing about computers was that the hardware was a big deal and the software wasn't so important. And in the early 80s, that started to change with microcomputers in the home and so on. Companies began selling and licensing software before no one really thought about it. So at these big universities, if you wrote some software that was useful, and someone from another university was visiting your campus and they snuck into the computer room and started chatting with their other fellow hackers because it was a shared kind of culture. And you saw a program that said, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's nice. I think we could use that. Do you mind? And they would borrow software like you would borrow a cup of sugar. It was no big deal, and everyone could program. And so software kind of flowed back and forth. And in 83 or 82, Richard Stallman, they got a new printer. And the printer driver, the printer had a problem where the printer would jam and stop. And so until somebody could go and just verify the jam. And a lot of times it wasn't actually jammed. It was a really, really easy thing to fix. All he had to do was grab the printer driver, make a quick change, no problem. So he traveled to Berkeley and he talked with one of the professors who had written that driver. And he said, you know, I'm having this trouble with the printer. Let me just have the driver and I'll fix it. I'll give you the fix back. Everything's set. The professor said, well, I can't do that. And he said, I've signed an agreement saying that I cannot help you. I cannot give that source code. That source code is secret. And this appalled Richard Stallman because when you have a computer and it's you can examine all the software and you can tell that it's doing what you want it to do. But when software is secret, and you don't know what's going on, your computer is not serving your purposes when you're running proprietary software. At least, there's no way to know. Your software is doing what the software vendor wants. And so your computer, in a sense, certainly becomes owned by the software vendor and not by you. Because you're not allowed to look at that. Now, there are various degrees. That's a very philosophical stance. And there are various degrees of how people think about this. But it's an interesting thing to think about because it's something we take for granted these days. And so he decided that he could see the way things were changing, where software began to be licensed in a way that you could no longer examine what you were running, that you could no longer help people when they were in need. And he didn't like it. So he created the GNU Manifesto and these ideas of free software that I just explained. And he decided that he was going to begin development. Back in those days, computers ran Unix, which was an operating system by Bell Labs. and it was proprietary to, it hadn't been, but in 83, so Bell Labs was, the Bell operating companies were split up, and Bell Labs was prohibited from selling Unix. So the software was out there, they would distribute the source code, professors would use it in class to teach how to use computers, how to create operating systems, and so on. And that restriction was lifted in the early 80s. And so Bell Labs decided that they weren't going to allow people to view the source code anymore, that they were going to restrict that. And so Richard Stallman said, well, I think there's a better way. I think the old way was better. So he developed the idea of free software. And he announced the GNU project. So the idea was, if you're running an operating system that you can't examine, your computer no longer really belongs to you. And so he decided he was going to implement an operating system completely composed of free software. He called it GNU. GNU, and that stands for GNUs, not Unix. And so he decided the operating system is really, really big. So he decided, that he was going to start with all the little commands and utilities that you use every day, so that every day, the things you're doing every day, you're using free software. We'll just replace the proprietary bits, all the commands, and we'll work up to the kernel. And that worked for a long time. They worked on this for a very long time. I think development started in, 85, actually. GNU project was founded in 84. 85, they started programming, and by the end of 1991, they were still working on the utilities. They didn't have that operating system kernel that actually controlled all the hardware. Yeah, they were still working. It was just a lot to work on. At the same time, a university student studying at the University of Helsinki in Finland got a new 386 computer, 386SX, with that great virtual machine multitasking functionality, and wanted to play with it. And he wanted a home system that could, there wasn't any software available. You could get, I think PCBSD wasn't quite available yet. It took another couple years. He used Unix, obviously, at school. Minix itself was an operating system that could only be used for educational use, and it cost like $300 for the source code, and then you could modify it for non-commercial use. Well, he didn't have $300. He was a student. So he decided he was going to make a Unix-like operating system, a kernel, so that he could get stuff done at home and have a familiar environment. And so he worked for a couple months, and he said, well, this is pretty interesting, and got it just real basic, and he posted on Usenet, which is like a giant message board at the time. He said, I'm working on this, and it's just not going to go anywhere. It's just like a hobby project. But it's called, I don't think he called it Linux. Someone else kind of came up with that name, and it stuck. So that student, of course, his name was Linus Torvalds. And Linus started this operating system kernel, and he thought it was kind of cool. So in November 1991, this free Unix-like kernel comes online. That's freely redistributable. Meanwhile, the GNU project's been floating around for years, and after 6 or 7 years, they have all these great utilities, but they don't have a free kernel. Meanwhile, Linux is interesting, and you can write programs for it, but a kernel by itself isn't interesting. It turns on, it boots, it just sits there, it's ready to run programs. There was no software to run. So these two projects were like missing pieces of each other's puzzle. And so what happened was that the GNU software to redistribute. And the Linux software was to Linus and said, hey, we have this great license called the GPL, and it lets people redistribute. And he said, that's great. We license the kernel under that. So now everything being under a free software license, you could build a full system. And people started doing exactly that because there wasn't a good Unix for PCs. And a couple years later, BSD came along, and that was actually pretty good, but Linux had begun growing in popularity, and so it didn't last, BSD didn't last very long. We just had a couple of years window there. So what happened was people started taking the Linux kernel that could talk to hardware and building all the software around it, and building packages so that you could install everything together, and you could have a free working operating system that just happened to cost no money and be, in most cases, every bit as good as that $800 Unix license or that $300 Megs license that anyone could use. And so there were a couple distros that so they were called distributions of Linux because they were prepackaged images you could use that would just work. So the there were a couple that came in, and one there was maintenance problems, and some software was being bundled, and there were licensing issues. So a couple people came together in 1990. What did I write? I didn't. Notes. 93. So 1993, about September 1993, two people got together and said, we want to have a Linux distribution that is openly developed, publicly out in the open, that is basically the same philosophy as the GNU project and Linux. We want everything to be put together in the open with volunteers. And we want to make sure everything is built out of free software so that this is always redistributable. And they called it Debian Linux. And so Debian was one of many, it's still around, so it's actually still around and fantastic. But it was one of the first, earliest truly free Linux distributions. They're always really careful when they add software that you rate. So if you take a Debian disk, you can give it to anyone. You can use it for any purpose. You don't have to worry about it because that's one of the core foundations of the software. Now, Debian was a huge success. Really good servers. They had great volunteers. The only problem was that it took a long time. The updates took a long time. New versions came out very slowly. The stable version, which was the released version, tended to be really out of date. And the unstable version was much more modern. And the testing version, that's where they add everything before it goes to unstable, you never knew. So you could kind of have a really old system, or you could have newer software and not be assured of the stability, or you could have bleeding edge stuff. It really was up to you. And so it's really difficult to build a business around that or a server around that if, obviously, you can't trust the reliability. And because Linux is free to distribute, free to use for private and commercial and educational purposes, the Internet started, the old Unix systems started to be replaced by Linux systems. And before you knew it, Linux was everywhere. And so in 2004, one Debian developer decided that he really liked Debian, and he really believed in those fundamental freedoms that the project espoused. But the schedule didn't work. The stability wasn't there. And there were a lot of rough edges. When you have a couple thousand people contributing little pieces here and there, it's hard to get a cohesive whole. And so in the early 90s, Mark Shuttleworth was a Debian developer, and he lived in South Africa. And he scraped together, in the early days of the web, he saw there was a need for identity verification. You know, you go to your bank, and Firefox has a little green icon. They are who they say they are, and you know you can trust the server. Well, those early days, that was just being built. So he created a company called Thoat, and it was one of the first companies that were selling these digital signatures and digital verification services. If you're a business, you send in your business paperwork, you confirm who you are, you send it back. They give you a special key that's signed by them that they verified everything. And now your browser, web browser knows that they can trust the website. So he did that. He built that out of Linux boxes from Debian and was able, with no capital, to build this sophisticated software infrastructure that he then sold to VeriSign, and he became a multimillionaire. So in 2004, he decided that he wanted to give back. He had this opportunity afforded to him by free software, and so he wanted to give back to the world. And so he said, well, let's take Debian, which is built on free software, which is stable, which has so many contributors, and let's take it and just freeze it, and we'll spend some time polishing it. We'll the trend at the old at the time in the old days was that you would download Linux, it would come on like 6 CDs, and you'd put everything in there, and there were like 20 different text editors, and there were 5 office suites, and there were 4 web browsers, and there were 20 email clients. And because everything's free and everyone has their own preference, so why not throw everything in there? And so there's pros and cons of that, but the main con is that it's a huge download, and if you're installing, if you're running an installer, and you get to select your packages, and now you have, 2,000 checkboxes, do you want to install this or that, how are you going to start, right? So we decided we're going to take Debian Linux, we're going to take that fresh, unstable version that's newer, we're going to freeze it, we're going to spend time polishing it, making sure all the software works together, we're going to make some choices. One email client, one web browser, one graphical text editor, 2 or 3 text editors, command line text editors, because there's a holy war over which is better, VI, Emacs, or Nano. Everyone who's right says Nano, but in my opinion, but you get those arguments. And bundle software so that one Office suite, so that you can take one CD, you can put it in, it's a quick install, and you have one software system that just does everything. And once you're installed, if you prefer other software, you can install it separate. That's not a problem. But just the base install, just to have a basic working operating system all on one disk. The goal at the time was one CD. And unfortunately, a couple years ago, we had to make it one DVD, but we're still capped at, I think, 800 megabytes. It's a pretty small disk. And so that started the Ubuntu project. Every 6 months, there's a new release of Ubuntu that takes Debian, polishes it, and as the Ubuntu project has matured, Ubuntu turned 10 years old in October, Ubuntu more and more has gone its own direction. So it has a certain vision, a single vision of design and a unified way of working. And the interesting thing is that that's what people needed at the time. Debian was stable, but again, not polished if you had modern software. So Ubuntu solved that problem. And in 2008, when the cloud infrastructure buzzword started gaining steam, Ubuntu decided that they were going to start building building tools for cloud use. And it turned out to be really good in servers. There was a lot of work done on the server. And so Ubuntu has built on the backs of giants, as the expression goes, this wonderful, complete solution for your computer. And the neat thing about that is that it works through a... So Ubuntu works in one single way, whether you use it on the desktop, on the server. And as technology advances, these phones that we all carry around are really turning into computers themselves. And so Ubuntu itself is moving towards also running on phones and tablets. And they're doing that in a really exciting way. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that after the break. But I think it's break time, right? I did? Excellent. Okay. So that was the big problem Ubuntu and any Linux distro had to solve. An operating system is great, but technically the operating system is just kernel. So Linux, as we always hear, is just the kernel. It's just that bit that talks to hardware. Just that bit that runs programs. And that's not really enough to have a working computer. What you really need are applications. You have a computer, you have your OS, now you want to get things done. And so that was the real sort of revolution in free software, is that you had this Linux kernel, and you had all these utilities, and they were all freely redistributable. So Ubuntu was able to build an operating system that took the best that free software had to offer. And because of the effect I described earlier, where everyone contributes and free software gets better and better, free software really did become something that was... So, for example, Firefox is a world-class web browser. It's not everyone's favorite browser, but But it's a solid, solid contender. It's the one I use. Nothing wrong with Chrome. Internet Explorer is actually pretty good nowadays. But Firefox came in and they got better and better and better and kept improving. Thunderbird is a great email client. LibreOffice is, when I signed the book contract, they said, we'll send you some Word 10 templates, just use those and then write your book and send it back. And I told them that I intended, if it caused problems, I would use Word, but I intended to only use free software to write my book about how to use free software. And sure enough, we'll see how the comments go back and forth. I'm starting to get revisions back, but so far everything's worked perfectly. I haven't had any trouble. And I especially didn't have any trouble spending $400 on Office because I didn't have to. And because LibreOffice is free, Ubuntu has the right to share it. And so an Ubuntu disk is pretty nice. That one disk has a complete operating system. And so that works towards a complete solution. And so Ubuntu, I think that's where, yeah, one more for a break, for the planned break. So Ubuntu has become the most flexible operating system in the world. It started up desktops and servers, but like I said, it moved into the cloud. And the neat thing about this was that when the cloud started coming up, so the cloud's a buzzword. Who here knows what cloud computing means? Servers, that's pretty good. Any other ideas what it might mean? Should be remote storage. No one really knows because it's a buzzword. Basically, usually what we mean when we say cloud, we mean computers. But basically, cloud infrastructure is a way of taking computing resources, processor, power, memory, disk storage space, and abstracting it so that you can sort of customize and flexibly allocate computing resources towards problems. And so we always think of the public cloud. We think of Google Drive, and we think about Dropbox and things like that. But if you're running a business, you may not necessarily want all of your data out in the cloud somewhere because you don't necessarily trust other people to either take care of things, or maybe you do, but you don't trust other bad people to attack, you know, this great storage that has all kinds of great corporate secrets. So you can actually have what's called a private cloud. You can get a couple racks and start putting servers in, and you can have them all work together, and you can work the exact same way. So Ubuntu develops tools early on that let you deploy. So install Ubuntu Cloud Server on all these things, and they all work together, and you can deploy virtual machines and cloud resources. And so on. And the nice thing is that those tools were made in such a way that the tools and processes run on your, you can have a couple of virtual machines on your laptop computer that you're developing on. And then you can take that and you can run those exact same commands and point them at your private cloud server. And if you don't have a private cloud server, because Amazon EC2 is extremely inexpensive, or if you outgrow your infrastructure, those exact same tools and commands can be pointed at a public cloud. So no matter what, you use the exact same tools, exact same processes on your desktop, your laptop, your server farm, public cloud. Everything works the exact same way everywhere that you use Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is poised to bring this same ease of use to phones and tablets as well. So when we come back, I'll be talking about Ubuntu on the desktop, how it might help you if you want to take it. We have some disks in back, I think, on the free table, and a little bit about where Ubuntu is going in the future with phones. So free software can be important, and it's something we take for granted, but it's something that really builds powerful solutions. And so this Ubuntu disk, this DVD, is a complete working solution for your computer. In fact, if you doubt that, this presentation and the demonstration I'm about to do on it is running off of a USB version of this disk. It's not actually running directly off my hard drive. So when I say that you can do
basically everything you do on a computer with Ubuntu, I really do mean what I say. So Ubuntu is a complete solution for your computer, and as part of a complete solution, it has a lot of different tools that help support the types of activities that you use your computer for. So for example, it comes with productivity tools. So it comes with Thunderbird email client. It has a contacts manager in Thunderbird. It doesn't come with calendar software, but if you use Gmail, Google Calendar, you can add your Google account to Ubuntu, and that integrates with the date time applet. So you, when you check the date and time in the calendar, it also shows you your Google Calendar events right there alongside everything else. And if you install something like Evolution, which works just like Outlook, it's email and contacts and calendars and tasks and to-do, that's built in too. That all works, everything works together harmoniously. It also has social media client software. So if you add your Flickr account or your Twitter account or your Facebook account, and you're browsing through your photos, you can automatically share those photos with your friends without leaving the program. And so productivity-wise, social networking-wise, the built-in messaging client supports like 20 different instant messaging chat programs, AOL, Google Talk, Yahoo Messenger, and a dozen more. It also, obviously, supports a web browser. We all need web browsers these days, whether it's check Facebook to keep in touch with family, or to read the daily news, or to use email in a web client like Gmail, or Hotmail, or Windows Live. Or if we just simply want to view pictures of cats on the internet. I think that's the most popular reason to use a web browser now, is pictures of cats. So, it comes with Firefox, yes. Pictures of cats. Cats. Yes. That's the killer feature of the internet and also smartphones, right? Ubuntu also comes with media software. So it has a photo gallery. So you can plug in your camera, plug in your smartphone. It will automatically, it doesn't just do it, you set it up, but it will automatically copy all your pictures off of your camera or your smartphone, put them in your pictures directory, show them in galleries, organize them by dates. You can do little color enhancements, red eye removal, you can crop them, you can share them. That, it's really easy to use, and it comes right with Ubuntu. You do that 20-minute install, and you're all set. It also comes with media software so that you can play back movies, DVDs. Blu-rays are a little tricky because of the copy protection, but it is possible if you have a Blu-ray drive. And so the movies, of course, you take on your, the video you take on your phone. And so that's all right there out of the box. Comes with a music manager that is sort of iTunes reminiscent. It lets you organize your music on your computer. You can rip music off of CDs. You can listen to internet radio. You can listen to podcasts. Whatever you do with music, video, pictures on your computer, you can do with Ubuntu right out of the box. Of course, Office Suite. So this presentation is running using LibreOffice Impress, which is just like PowerPoint. And it comes with LibreOffice. So you're able to do word processing, spreadsheets, presentations. It comes with a PDF viewer. So if you, you're on the web. And now, Windows 8 finally does come with a PDF viewer. Anything older than that, and you have to, you get your first PDF, and now you have to go and find Adobe, you have to go to adobe.com, click on Adobe Reader, uncheck the toolbar stuff, download the thing, install it, wait for it to optimize, and 20 minutes later, you're ready to read that document. In Ubuntu, it just works. There is not really voice recognition. Some people are working on that. It's sort of slow. It's actually a really hard problem. But speaking along those terms, The other really, really neat thing that Ubuntu has, one of the great features, is accessibility. And so these are things we think about, such as a screen reader. So if you have low vision, you might want to use a screen reader to read back text on your screen. And Ubuntu can do that right out of the box. It has high contrast themes. And when I say right out of the box, I mean when you boot the install disk, you can turn on text-to-speech and you can do the entire installation with the screen and steps being read back to you. So from the very beginning. And there's one other thing that we're so lucky we get to take for granted. But one part of accessibility is localization. What that means is that you can take the Ubuntu disk that I have here, and right out of the box from the installer, you can choose one of about 45 different languages, and Ubuntu will work in each of those languages from start to finish. So you can, if you're more familiar with a different language, if you're more comfortable with a different language, you can put in and install Ubuntu, and you can do all your functions and computer work in that language. And that's something, like I said, is really easy to take for granted as English speakers. But it really is something special if you're in some part of the world where English is not so common. I got to take advantage of it because if I install Spanish and German support, now in LibreOffice, I can set my document language, and the spell checker now works in that language. And that's where I get the benefit. So I get some benefit, even though it's not for me. Really, it allows people all over the world to enjoy Ubuntu and to have ownership of their computer in a way that isn't always possible with Windows and OS X. And because Ubuntu is community developed, even people who aren't developers can help translate and localize Ubuntu into their language, and people do. For example, the Ubuntu Catalan team in Catalonia, Spain, they don't speak Spanish, they speak Catalan. And they actually, they're one of the best contributors, and so Ubuntu is available in Catalan because there are a team of people who made that their goal. And so they, thanks to them, if you speak that language, it's available. I don't know if it's available for OS X or Windows. I would be surprised. I don't know. But with Ubuntu and free software, no one had to wonder about it. They just had to want it, and they could make it happen. So Ubuntu is pretty good for accessibility. And the other nice thing about Ubuntu, so I said earlier how the great best feature of Ubuntu was that it didn't come with 20 web browsers and 15 text editors and so on. There's one thing. But what if you hate Firefox and you want to use Chrome? Or you don't like LibreOffice and you want to use something else? The nice thing about Ubuntu is that it comes with the Ubuntu Software Center. I talked about Debian and how it had so much software available. And pretty much all of that software is also available in Ubuntu. And Ubuntu offers a simple, easy-to-use interface called the Ubuntu Software Center, which is an online catalog that allows you to access and install software. And so you don't have to search websites. You don't have to go looking for what's the real website and worry about downloaders and installers and whether or not there's a toolbar added, whether or not there's viruses, whether or not you need to go back to the website every other week and check for updates because a new version comes out or there's a security fix. When you install software included with Ubuntu, Ubuntu itself, because it's free software, they have the right and the freedom to modify that software. So they're able to, when a version comes out or a security exploit is found, they're able to fix it, share that fix upstream, or incorporate it if upstream gets to it first, and then deliver that to your computer. So your software is fully up to date, and all updates for all software on your computer are tracked automatically in one location. So that means that Ubuntu gives you complete peace of mind. And when I first installed Ubuntu, I used it for about a year. I really liked it. And when Vista was coming out, I decided I didn't like the more aggressive Windows Genuine Advantage activation. The only advantage I could see was Microsoft's. And so I decided, well, this might be the time. I've been using Linux since 94, and it's been, you know, it's been about, 12 years. And Ubuntu is really exciting. I'm going to switch. And the day my desktop had Windows. We used a dual boot. My laptop usually had whatever I was working on, exploring, usually Ubuntu. I could just wipe it and reinstall, and a couple days later, you know, put whatever else on. And it more and more often, it just had Ubuntu. And the day I installed Ubuntu and put it on my computer was the day I stopped worrying about my computer and updates. And the day all I had to do when I sat down at my computer was just work or have fun. I didn't have to worry about the software and updates. And the nice thing about this is that you get to choose how often you want to update. So, for example, Windows XP went 10 years without an update to Windows. It took forever. And that worked. XP was pretty stable. But I would have liked updates, you know, at the time. It turned out to be Vista, and I wasn't happy. But, you know, you can't win every time. Ubuntu updates every 6 months. And so in April, there's an update. My laptop is running Ubuntu 14.10. Came out in October. And in April, it'll be running, I'll upgrade, it'll be running 15.04. And in October, it'll be running 15.10, because I'm going to do an automatic update. It asks you first. And I'm going to update, and it's going to upgrade all the software that's been updated. It's going to install. All my data will be safe. And on my server, where I don't want to do updates every 6 months, because I want to have the things running and stable and not just constantly do updates. And I don't care if the things are a little out of date, because I'm not running a lot on the server. So on my server, I have Ubuntu 14.04, and 14.04 was a long-term support release. And what that means is that it has support for 5 years. So Ubuntu 14.04 is supported for 5 years from that date with security and maintenance updates. And so even though there's a new version every 6 months, I can install 14.04, which is what's on those DVDs, and I have complete peace of mind for 5 years. I'm not going to have security vulnerabilities. Software isn't changing out from under me. It's going to be the same. 4 years from now, that's going to be boring. Right now, it's great. And so when you have a virus, the way that they attack is they find vulnerabilities and flaws in your running software. And so with Ubuntu, there's a security team that all supported versions of Ubuntu are actively monitored. And when a vulnerability is discovered, Canonical is one of several companies that secretly they share information, work on a fix, get it fixed, push out the update, and then publish what the problem was. Microsoft does that, Canonical does it, Red Hat, SUSE, Novell, quite a lot. A lot of the antivirus manufacturers. The virus manufacturers don't share that. Antivirus ones do. And so, when you run Ubuntu, when there's a security exploit found, it's patched, an update is pushed, and you're notified that you have the ability, you can install it. So for 5 years, I'm not going to have to worry about this. Every 2 years, they take, generally a version of Ubuntu is supported for 9 months. So about halfway through the next life cycle of the next version. Because they want you upgrade, you keep up to date. Every 2 years, they pick a version called a long-term support release, LTS. 14.04 is an LTS release. So for 5 years, that's going to be updated and supported by Canonical and Ubuntu. Canonical is the company founded by Mark Shuttleworth to do all the businessy stuff. Ubuntu is all community driven. And they work together, so they're going to support Ubuntu for 5 years. And so 14.04 was the last release in April of last year. And so that means that in April of next year, every 2 years, in April 2016 will be a new version. And by that time, 14.04 is four versions out of date. Three versions out of date. So what you can do when you have an LTS release is you can jump over the old versions and go straight to 16.04. So when the next LTS release comes out when you're running Ubuntu, you can update and get the newest, greatest thing It's nice and secure and stable. We work really hard on these LTS releases to make them really rock solid because we're supporting them for 5 years. We don't want to make our job harder. When it comes out, you have 3 more years to decide if you're even interested because you're secure and up-to-date and protected. So there's a regular, consistent, dependable schedule that you can rely on. And so you can choose how you want to use your computer. Now, Ubuntu itself is pretty interesting. I'm going to actually give a demonstration before I jump in here, but I'm going to show off Ubuntu and show a bit about how it works and some cool things. And it's a really pretty OS. I think everyone will like it. And I'll talk a little bit about the phone. So this is the Ubuntu desktop. Okay. And if my mouse will work, nice thing about wireless mice is they turn off. Thanks. So this is the Ubuntu desktop. When you do an install, this is what it looks like right out of the box. And so it's very familiar, but you'll see some differences. You have a panel here at the top and a launcher here on the left. And the way this works is that I don't know if I can lower the projector. That's a good question. The top is this black bar right here. Excellent. Can we drop the projector a little bit? Yeah, I think further back maybe. Well, it's not cutting it from my side either, so, you know. I'm glad you mentioned it. That looks pretty good. Excellent. Okay. So the way this works is that you have your launcher on the left-hand side. And these contain your favorite apps that you use every day. Just like in Windows 7, you can pin specific applications. This is your main way to launch your everyday applications. And these are just the defaults. You can right-click and you can customize these. The dash button here runs, and it allows you to search your computer as well as online sources. So for whatever reason, online searching didn't appear to be working, and I don't know why, because it always works when I'm not demonstrating something. But I can choose to run, so this shows me, and I click the dash, or press the Windows key. This shows me the last couple programs I've run, as long as they're not here on the side. And I can also type in and search something. So if I want to do photo management, I can start to type in photos. And I see here I have Shotwell Photo Manager. I have a webcam software. I have GIMP Image Editor, which is a free work-alike that works like Photoshop. And I have different, so I also have files that I've opened in these programs also show up. So if I search for presentations, I also get not just my presentation software, also the files I've opened in that software. So it's a really quick, easy way to run applications. I'll run the photo editor. And so as I said here, this will take in photos I've taken pictures of from my camera. It'll automatically import them. It sorts them by date and time. And I can do adjustments and just really, really quick adjustments. Now, without having to be a photo expert. If you are a photo expert, that's okay too. You can run really powerful software here. So you're not limited here. You have all the power that you need, but you're not required to be an expert before you work on something. The other really nice thing that is a killer feature of Ubuntu that nobody kind of really sees is that I have a photo editor here, and the menus, first of all, the menus are always at the top of the screen. They're hidden, so they don't clutter the screen, but they're there when I need them. And as you can imagine, there are a lot of different options in a really powerful, professional-grade photo editor. And so what I can do is I can tap the Alt key, which is the keyboard accelerator in Windows. You can Alt-F gives you the file menu. Alt-E gives you edit. And that works here, too. Alt-F also. Alt-F does the same thing. If I tap Alt, and I type in, say, blur, This will search through the menu, so I don't have to know where something is. I can say that, oh, blur, right there. Filters, blur, filter, there's Gaussian blur, there's all these different features. I can just pick the one I want. So this is super useful in this program. It's super useful in LibreOffice and Writer and Calc. So that's a really, really great feature. And the other nice thing here, too, is that, close this here. So this dash search will search a lot of different sources. And so I can go down here, I have different scopes, and I can say I just want to look through music. And if I look through music, it will search everything in my music folder. So without having to open up my photo editor, my music manager, I can just type in something. I'm now blanking of like every single song that I've ever, So I can go here and I can click on something and I can see an album. And I can click and just hear a preview. And, I can search through and find exactly what I'm looking for very, very, very quickly. And the same thing with photos and files and so on. And so there's an application lens. And the nice thing about this is, say I'm interested in astronomy. And I don't have astronomy software installed. I can look for star chart. Here we have a program called Stellarium, which is a virtual planetarium. Now if I click on it, so it tells me, it gives me a screenshot, gives me a description here, and it happens to be a free download. So I said it was the easiest thing in the world. If you want to install software in Ubuntu, you can use the Ubuntu Software Center. And you can also use the dash here, and all I have to do is click on free download, put in my password, which I don't have because this is running off the disk. And what this will do, and what this has always done every other time I've done this, is it will start installing automatically. Let's go to the Software Center just in case. So if I'm looking for an application that is not installed, I can also see not what's on my computer, but also what might be available to me, all in one place. Now with the Software Center, same thing. So I'm going to type in, I know I'm looking for Stellarium, so I'm going to type that in. And it looks like, is it going to be one of those days? Stellarium, there we go. So I'll click install. And so there we go. So it's installing here, it downloads. I pre-downloaded it, so it's installing. And when this is done, it will be on my computer ready to go. It was just that easy. I didn't have to do anything else. It's installing right now. This is the description. And this is pretty nice software here. So we have a situation here where all your programs you can access here on the left. At the top here you have all your menus. And here on the side we can click, these are called indicators. And no matter what program I'm using, I can also always see status about my computer. For example, here's a sound menu. Not only does it let me adjust my volume, also lets me start my music player. And if I happened to be running other programs here and playing music, I would be able right here just to pause and play software. I have no idea why that's taking so long, because I tested everything yesterday and everything was working. Yeah, so LibreOffice Writer looks pretty much just like Word 2003 used to. And what I'm going to do here, it is fully compatible with Word. You can read, edit, save. You can actually start in an Open Document text format, and you can save in Word. So it supports all these different formats. It can open. It doesn't save all of them. Some of these are like, it doesn't save the WordPerfect version 2, for example. But it can read them. So if you have a document, it can probably read it. And so I can go through, so here's my presentation, and that will pops up over here. And so PowerPoint looks just the same, you know, more or less. Calc looks just like Excel. So all your basic workhorse, everyday stuff, you're going to be pretty happy with. Well, even better, when you open a document and you hit save, it will save in that same format. Yeah, so it's not trying to lock you in like some other software. Right. Nor should they. I mean, that's, you know, like, their software shouldn't impact you, your software shouldn't impact them. No, Ubuntu works with everything. So Open Document Text is the standard, and Office supports that as well. Right. So let's take a look. So this opens. So I can be working in my document, and I can play music. Where did it go? Here. And you can't hear the music, but that's okay, because that's you need to hear me. So I get a notification up here that tells me about the change. And I can click through that. That doesn't block me. And I can actually jump up here and pause it without ever leaving my word processor. When I maximize the window, it opens up, so the menus are up here. I don't have all this double wasted space. So it's really, really form efficient. And so now I can actually come in here and load Stellarium. So in a click, I was able to say I wanted a virtual planetarium and say that I wanted to just install it and then go about my business, show other things because it decided it was going to take 5 minutes instead of the 30 seconds it took yesterday when I ran through this. But here it is. And I went about my business, and it worked in the background. And sure enough, I can go in here, and if I can remember the key command to accelerate time... it defaults, I don't remember where it defaults, you can set your location, and it is a full featured planetarium software that shows you, you know, just what's going on in photorealistic, detail. And in fact, that wasn't pause. There we go. Let me see here. Mars, for example. Or say the moon. You all know what that looks like. So if I go to the moon, the other nice thing, too, is that I can zoom in. Don't know why I didn't pick the moon. Let's see here. Moon. I can zoom in, and it shows me just what it looks like just right now. And if I accelerate time, it will actually... This is a 3D representation, so you see the moon's actually moving. This is exactly the way it looks in real life. And that is 100% free. It also works on Mac and Windows, so if you like this and aren't sold on Ubuntu, there's no bait and switch. You don't have to switch over. But that's an example of software, really super high-quality software that's available. So if you have one of the later XP machines with a graphics card, you shouldn't have any trouble. You can use 1 gig of RAM, 2 is better. The actual base install only takes about, 4.3 gigabytes of disk space storage for everything here. 4.3, right? So, you know, Windows XP, or Windows, 7, for example, wants 20 gigabytes, and then you can't do anything with it when you're done. There's no Office software, right? So, you want about 6.5 or 7 gigabytes total is what's recommended. 10 is best. And you get everything here. So the neat thing about this interface is it's really easy to use, and there's been a lot of work done in this interface to make it sort of work everywhere. And so eventually it's moving towards, more and more we're using our phones and our tablets, and we have Android and iOS. Ubuntu has some really interesting ideas about phones, and I want to show this video really quick that shows where Ubuntu is going for phones. So I will reboot. I'm dual booting on my Nexus 5. I will reboot into Ubuntu, and everyone can take a look afterwards if they want. But this is what the phone looks like. This is a welcome screen. And so it shows, this welcome screen shows you, this graphic changes based on how you are using your phone. So it says 2 text messages received a day, and it will change as you use your phone to reflect your usage. Now, this is the main launcher screen. It looks a lot like the dash that showed your applications. And on the left, you have your launcher, just like on your computer. On the top, you have indicators. So you can see your battery status, messages, networks, messages, exactly the way you use your computer. So if you get familiar with Ubuntu, you're also on the phone. A right edge swipes between the last used application. And you can always flip back and forth. And the bottom edge of the screen is used per application. So in the clock app, for example, I can swipe up from the bottom, set a new alarm, and I'm all set. So edge gestures really control the way you use your phone. It doesn't use any hardware buttons. On the main screen, I can also search through scopes. So I can search for weather, for example. I can search through, I can see the music installed on my phone locally, as well as here it shows albums on 7 Digital for sale, on SoundCloud, on Grooveshark, on YouTube. The music scope, the flick of a wrist, gives me music information. Here's video. There are a lot of different scopes. I can, for example, there's a Reddit scope, so I can swipe over, and you're never far away from a picture of a cat on the internet with your Reddit scope. So that obviously makes Ubuntu a killer phone. And your home screen is always available for you right there, no matter what. And the other nice thing is that this is literally running Ubuntu. So if I run, for example, the music app, it's pretty easy, it's pretty simple. It controls just like you would expect any mobile application to run. But if I run the weather app, for example, I really like, weather's a big thing for me, so here's the weather app, for example, and I can tap, and it expands and shows me more information. It's a beautiful touch screen interface, optimized for a mobile touchscreen device. But this is an Ubuntu application running on Ubuntu. And so this means that I can go over to my laptop computer running Ubuntu, and I can run the weather app, and this is the exact precise same code that was running on the phone. This is the exact same program that was running on the phone, running on my computer. And so you might say, well, this is a touchscreen app, and I don't really want a touchscreen app on my computer. And we're working really hard to converge those interfaces. So if I expand this and make this full screen, now, so I don't have this little tiny window, now it knows it's a full screen, it uses the entire screen. So we're working on making applications you can write once for Ubuntu that you write once and they run everywhere. And the interface adapts so that it works one way on a touchscreen on a phone, one way on a tablet, and works on the desktop just like a native desktop app. We're working on that last bit right now. And so with a phone running Ubuntu in the next couple of years, what we're planning is that you can take, so I can have my phone right here, and if this were running Ubuntu, and it is when I dual boot, I can take this phone running Ubuntu, and I can take this, and so, say I'm going to a convention, I'm going traveling for work, and I need a computer, right? I can have my phone that has all my applications, and when I get to the hotel, I plug this phone into the TV, and I use a Bluetooth mouse and keyboard, and on the, it's a phone, I have all my apps, but on the display, I have a desktop interface. A desktop interface that looks just like that. And I can run LibreOffice, and I can run Shotwell, and all the pictures that I took on my phone on vacation, as I was traveling, all my emails, all my messages, everything is available right on my phone, just like a computer interface. So I don't have to drag my laptop around. My phone by itself will do it. I'm still going to have a phone and a laptop and a desktop, but when I'm traveling, I can travel light. And that software that I have come to rely upon on my desktop computer and on my server will also power my phone as well. So nobody else is doing this right now. We're actually looking at, Microsoft has some interface issues. iOS, Apple is converging, having their two OSs talk to each other. Ubuntu is the only one that is focused on having one operating system that runs everywhere. And one application that runs everywhere. And it will adapt itself to the device you're working on. So that's a pretty cool thing. So Ubuntu is all about community. So the neat thing about Ubuntu is that we all work together and we help each other out. So Ubuntu is a philosophy. Ubuntu is an African philosophy that means I am who I am, I am what I am because of who we all are. And so that means that if I help my neighbor's in need, and I help him and I lift him up, I don't just lift up my neighbor, but I lift up the entire community that we live in and myself as well. And so Ubuntu has a lot of great support resources, and it's really kind of hard to describe without seeing it. So what I would like to do is invite all of you, first of all, to visit Ubuntu.com and download a disk if you didn't get one in the back. It's free to download. It's a free DVD. You can boot off of the disk, and you can once you boot off of the disk, you can boot off of it and run it just like I have here without installing anything. And the other thing is that there's an expo coming up in February, and this is why I wanted my slide, because it has a discount code. So I'm sure that in the newsletters that you'll get this information. The Southern California Linux Expo is going to be at the Hilton LAX February 19th, which is Thursday, all the way to the 22nd, which is a Sunday. And it is a fantastic experience. It's a cross between a trade expo, where we have people talking about servers and development and really cool things, and a fan convention. So there are also people talking about, they're teaching classes, teaching basic concepts, talking about cool gadgets that run Linux. There's an exhibitor hall, there's two of them actually, that have booths from software projects. So for example, so Firefox is going to be there. If you know and love VLC, they've always been there the last few years, they'll probably be there again. Ubuntu will be there, I'm running the booth there. There's Fedora, OpenSUSE, HP, Google, Disney was there 2 years ago. I stopped by the Disney booth, and they told me that every single Disney.com web server that's public-facing is running Ubuntu. And so it's a really, really great way to learn more about Linux, learn more about these projects, and have a lot of fun doing it. Everyone's so super friendly. And so, do you have a question? Okay. So where does the money come from? Well, the neat thing is that a lot of these programmers are going to be programming anyway, and they may as well share. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of community work. If you really, the Stellarium people are into astronomy, and a company said, it's a virtual planetarium basically. So there's a company that sells projectors, for example, that sponsors them and makes sure that they build this wonderful free software. So when they sell their $3,000 inflatable planetariums for schools, there's a software there that everyone can use. And they get the advantage of lots of free development as well. IBM contributes a lot of money to Linux because all of their servers, all of their iron run Linux. Canonical supports Ubuntu directly. They sell support services, engineering and hardware enablement for corporations. So Dell pays them to make sure the Dell XPS 13 developer system runs Ubuntu. Ubuntu runs perfectly on that computer. And the phones, for example, there are two Ubuntu phones coming out this year. One's coming out in 1 month by BQ in Europe. And so you'll be able to walk into a store in Europe and purchase an Ubuntu phone that comes with Ubuntu and walk out of the store with it. And so they get money that way as well.